everyone. We have great guests joining us today for a pretty important conversation about diversity, equity, and systemic racism in animal welfare. Our first guest is Jose Ocano. He is the Senior Director for People and Culture for Best Friends Animal Society. He joined Best Friends in 2017 after having a background in shelter management, both in Arizona and Florida. He started at a shelter as a technician in 2005 at an open mission shelter that took in more than 30,000 animals a year. Our second guest is James Evans, who has spent the last 25 years developing relationships between organizations and their constituents. In March of 2020, James and his team founded a new organization called CARE, which stands for Companion and Animals for Reform and Equity. James serves as president and creative director. And the best news is that one of my favorite co-hosts, Jorge Ortega, is back to co-host today. Jorge has spent more than 20 years working in animal welfare and currently serves on the board of directors for the North Carolina Animal Welfare Coalition. He is the animal services director for Guilford County in North Carolina. Jorge, thank you for joining me yet again for what I think is going to be a pretty amazing conversation.
Catherine, thank you for allowing me to host.
So, James, Jose, how are you two doing? There's been a lot going on in the world these past 6 months.
James, my friend, go for it.
We have our own individual support calls where we chatted out for 20 minutes. I mean, I am well, and I have to say, you know, that all things considered probably means more now than it has before. But all is well, there's lots of work to do. But I'm inspired by, you know, all the people I've met that are about the work, and Jose included. So I appreciate the question.
Yeah, no, I feel the same. I'm doing good. I think for me, it's being as of service. And right now we're all being called to, you know, kind of step up and really do the hard work. And I feel incredibly motivated right now. And really just emotionally, while it's really challenging, like your word, James, I'm inspired. I'm really inspired right now by the incredible work being done across our industry and beyond.
Yeah. Kind of leading off with the word inspired. And when we're trying to inspire others to have the conversation about DEI, in my opinion, I believe animal welfare lacks the diversity and inclusion aspect of just society as a whole. What advice do you have to a shelter director like me to support diversity, equity, and inclusion within our organizations? Jose, we'll start with you.
You know, I would say the first thing that I would recommend, it's also what we did at Best Friends, it's doing an actual evaluation of what are your diversity dimensions? What is the actual makeup? You know, we're an industry that loves data. I think this is an area where we should collect data. And beyond looking at your makeup, which I think most organizations are looking to further diversify their workforce, I also say, look at your applicant pool. You might be surprised that there are diverse candidates in your applicant pool. And there are likely unintentional things happening that are filtering those candidates out, work experience, education levels, and things like that. So I would say do some data digging and just get a good understanding of where you are so that you can start to build out a roadmap that you can measure on where you want to be. What do you think, James?
Yeah, well, you know, we're working together on these very same issues, right? So I agree like 100%, right? There are very pragmatic things I think you've nailed. And then on the other side, there are, I think, you know, very emotional things, but they're also tied to data. For instance, you know, when I think of animal welfare anyway, I think I'm trying to encourage directors of shelters and also directors of organizations to stop thinking of animal welfare as singularly our industry and think about it, I think, at another elevated level. Everyone that is at home right now taking care of a pet really, to me, is a caretaker. They're part of our industry. Right. And when you think that there are 40 million plus people of color with pets, that's an enormous pool for us to draw from. Right. Those are people that care exactly the way we care. And so we need to start thinking about them as in the room and possibly possibly ignored, but let's not think of them as outside of animal welfare. I think that would be a mistake. So definitely, pragmatically, the applications, the way we say hello on our phones, the way we say hello on our websites. So my background is mass communications, and I think when you go to a web animal welfare website, animal welfare industry focused website, that is, often you don't see people of color in leadership, nor do you see them on the sort of inspirational pages. We often only see folks when they are receiving a service that's connected with being underserved. So free food, free spay neuter, free shots. I think we need to start showcasing people of color that are inspiring us and helping us do our work, our volunteers, our donors, and so on. So that when people are looking at us, they're not thinking, oh, I don't want to be in that industry because that industry, I don't see myself represented at all in that industry. And I, for one, know that people of color, particularly on the executive level, are looking for themselves inside of organizations in hopes that they will see something that feels welcoming. So it's all so important.
Yeah, you know, when James talks about narrative is so important, not just the stories we're telling outwardly, but about ourselves. And I think that oftentimes it's exactly what you described. We hear this narrative of people of color and it's in this, like they need something as though they don't have just as much to contribute and are actually contributing right now. And so I think that a holistic view of things becomes really important. And you know, even when I look at Best Friends or other places that when I'm having conversations about diversity, and even when there's not as many diverse people within their workforce, you still have those folks. And so part of that is how do you best leverage them in ways that they are interested in and that really serve not only your mission, but like the greater mission at whole, like start at home. I'm just a big believer of like just starting at home.
Yeah. And agree 100%. And to sort of add on to that, I want to make clear that for CARE, we are linking life-saving to inclusion. And that means inclusion, including all marginalized people, people without homes, people with children, because so often people with children are looked over for adoption, people who work long hours, people without fences, and senior citizens. I mean, not only do I believe that senior citizens make incredible adoptees, right? Senior citizens are, to me, way too often overlooked in terms of leadership. I feel like we are a community that keeps repeating mistakes because we are devaluing our elders. I mean, there are seniors that retire at 65 and they're lucid and completely competent into their 80s, right? But we are in many ways a throwaway society. And when you think of Indigenous people and how closely rooted their current decisions are to checking in with their elders, it really is something I think we are missing out on. So, and obviously LGBTQ community as well. I mean, when we say diversity, we mean it in the most deeply rooted way possible. This should not be about middle class folks, period. And if you're not middle class, we sort of don't want your leadership, but we're asking for donations from everybody, but we only want a certain amount of people to come in and be leaders and to adopt. So.
Yeah, and you know, we always are trying to recruit that diverse crowd. And there's times we already have that diverse crowd engaged in our organization. So what would you tell that individual of color, person of color, the BIPOC, that is already currently working or volunteering in an organization, and they want to, you know, bring DEI into their organization? What would be your advice, James?
I would welcome it with open arms. That one, there's nothing to be afraid of. I have been saying this over and over again. This is really about not only just life-saving in particular to this industry, but people of color, and I think marginalized people in general, bring a special skill set to the table. When you have, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. And so when you are coming from a community that is a community of people that are used to not having much, those survival skills become very creative. You know, being able to talk to someone that is, you know, it's that old saying, you know, my mom goes into the cabinet, apparently there's nothing to eat in my mind, but somehow mom makes something. Azuela invents something out of nothing. And Azuela takes that to work. You know, I think so often, I've worked in plenty of places where it seems like we don't have the resources of a large firm. But then I start digging around and putting one tool or another tool together, and all of a sudden, we have something that looks very much like a much larger firm. And folks come to me and they say, how did you figure that out? And I said, my people have been doing this forever, right? This is how you survive in a community where you are institutionally marginalized. You have to be more creative. So often those people of color that are working for us, their families, their friends, and other marginalized people have found a way to survive in a community that has often limited them. So you're bringing in to me, when that person comes to you, you should be thinking, wow, this person is coming from a community that has learned to survive against all the odds, right? And what are they bringing to the workplace that can help us go to the next level with that kind of creativity and in many ways, empathy and compassion, because so often, not all the time, those who have been sort of downtrodden and misused and marginalized are coming out on the other end with an open heart, if it hasn't been broken, right? With an open heart and a level of compassion that's unmatched by those who haven't had to traverse that same course. So much value in it.
Yeah, I think about it in that, I remember when I was in Pima working there, some, if not most of our best ideas came from our staff who are working, you know, as kennel attendants or our volunteers. Because of Pima being in Tucson, Arizona, many of these folks were also, you know, from diverse backgrounds. And they just brought a different perspective. They brought grit, like you said, and creativity. And I think there is so much work to be done that only when it's shared is it possible to be accomplished. Yeah. And so I'm always a big supporter and believer that creating those open channels and lines of communication and being truly like receptive to the ideas that people are wanting to bring forward and empowering them to be able to actually execute those ideas. I always thought of myself as the director, I'm just here to remove barriers to all of the really good ideas. Like that was my job then. And I still think of that as my main job in leadership now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I cannot tell you. And I think that we have this thing in this country, it's almost palpable. You know, when you say you are of color, it's almost a competition for strength. You know, you're too often, particularly in my experience anyway, middle-aged white men who look at my background and they say, you know, my great-grandfather was also dirt poor and we also came from nothing. And it's like, you know, I'm telling my narrative and this person's telling their narrative, and it's always this kind of balance out. And I try the best I can to be patient and say, yes, we, from a social economic background, we may come from the same place, but add being a person of color on top of that, add being sort of criminalized just by your skin tone, and there's a whole other degree aside from that social economic climb. And that degree of change just because of melanin puts my life at risk. It puts my family's lives at risk. And so when you're able to sort of have that, not only that social economic climb, that experience, but understanding those really, really narrow passages that you have to go through when you're a person of color, that navigation, it fine tunes you, I think, for problem solving at levels that most of us don't have to deal with. And by the way, should not have to deal with, but you certainly learn a lot about human nature as a person of color. And I think it brings that dynamic, brings a lot of potential wisdom to leadership roles. I see it constantly. I see it in Shafonda Davis. I see it in yourself, Jose. And I know where it comes from. I see it because we have a very special path that we have to orchestrate, that the margin of error is very, very small. And I think often people of color, when they are able to ascend to leadership positions, they're so much more forgiving than the world is to them as they're trying to navigate their way up to the top. And I think that's where that compassion comes from. So it's that might be anecdotal, but I think it's very palpable in my experience.
I think it's interesting to like hear you say that, because as you were talking, I was also reflecting on what has helped me, you know, in my career, in my relationships, and all the things that I really value. And it's where I came from, you know, and I grew up in this little barrio. We grew up on welfare, you know, it's very cliche, but it is what it was, my upbringing. And that kind of the coping skills, the ability to deal with very high stressful situations and be able to bounce back. Even the compartmentalization that was needed to deal with coping with things that helped me be a euthanasia technician when I was 18 years old. These are all things that have allowed me to kind of navigate. And that's why when I see people who come from really different and diverse backgrounds, they have a lot of times life experience at the age of 18 and 19 that 40, 50, 60-year-olds may not have. So they come with a wisdom and a life experience that is rich and really adds like depth into your culture and your workforce.
And I think for us, for a long time as an animal welfare industry, we looked at diversity as your education, diverse experience in education.
Sure.
I don't think as an industry, as animal welfare industry, we actually dove into the diversity of your background. When we say background, we're thinking like, oh, they went to college or they graduated high school, or they don't have they don't have a criminal record, right? That type of background. We don't really take the time to get to know the individual. We look at the diversity of like, oh yeah, they've had that training, or no, they haven't. So I'm happy to hear both of you like really digging in and talking about just the bigger, the core of what we should be focusing, and not just on someone's resume and saying, here's the diversity that I bring to this organization.
No, it's diversity of narrative. I mean, honestly, if I was living in a community today and I was a director and I was looking for diversity, and either I could not get someone to move someone of color to move to where I was, or there were people of color that simply were not near me, I would start looking for the next best thing, which I think is diversity of narrative, right? When you're talking to someone that is a cancer survivor, right? That person that may have been given a very short life sentence and had to find a way to get the grit to move through the cancer and all the emotional battles that come along with that, that person, assuming they survive, are gonna bring something to the table that is different than someone else. It's just part of the human condition. And I think so often when it pertains to race, there is a competitive nature to it. I think there is a fear factor for people that are non-minorities that somehow we are saying, because we are minorities, we are special or more equipped or whatever. I think it's just about humanity. And, you know, humanity has its arcs. If you are fortunate enough to be of good health and come from a wealthy family and you don't have those struggles, it's not that it makes you a bad person, doesn't mean that you're not smart, but that person that has none of that that could be a cancer survivor that swings upward in spite of, that grit factor matters. And often those people bring that to, it brings it to leadership, but they also bring it just to work, even when they're not in leadership. And so I think we have to, in this field, and I think in general, start really having conversations with people as we're talking about employment, in the same way we should be having conversations with people when it comes to adoption. Not just looking at an application, but absorbing a person's narrative means in many ways you're absorbing that real person and not just what is, you know, almost incalculable on an application. So
I want to ask a question about white fragility. And so there are a lot of great books, including that one, that, you know, speaks to helping people understand what systemic racism really is and how a voice of privilege can impact your life and your decisions. And so what I have found in recent months is that there are a lot of people who really are beginning to learn a new point of view that they just weren't aware before. And so I'm really encouraged by that, and I'm very excited by it. With that in mind, I'd like to hear from both of you. What would you tell a white person who wants to act in support of racial equity at their organization, but they feel unclear about what they should do? And Jose, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, that's a very complex and I think question. I think also it's going to vary for the individual. So I think the first step, and I've talked to a lot of my colleagues about this, it's about just doing your self-work, right? So just kind of like identifying and assessing what's your privilege, what systems have you benefited from, what systems have you actively, unintentionally, intentionally participated in. Because this question is something that my colleagues ask, and I've given them a few things that they can start now. And part of that is, you know, self-awareness is everything in life, I think. And so being self-aware of the amount of space you take up in a room. Are there other people of diverse backgrounds who are used to being quiet a lot of times? Like, we're taught to, you know, to be quiet in many, many ways. And so, like, are you sharing your airspace? Are you in a position to provide someone else with a platform? Like, I'm in a great leadership role at Best Friends, so I'm in a position to really give other voices a platform and share, and also kind of not only their experiences, but their ideas, and make sure that they remain the owners of those ideas. You know, that's something, like, I learn so much from James all the time. And it's really conscious and important to me that when James says something that is astute and profound, that I'm just not regurgitating it as my own thought. It's like, James said this and really made me think. Like, that's really important, doing those kinds of things. And a lot of times we unconsciously are taking ideas or we're taking up space. And so those are some, I think, things that people can start to do today in the workplace. I think if you are in charge of hiring people, I think looking at, are you hiring people who are just like you? Like, what kind of things can you do to start to incorporate more diversity? Do you create a safe space for the diverse voices in your organization to actually speak up? If not, start to build those relationships with them. We want to, it's a very fine balance between creating the space for the people who want it and not creating tokenism and expecting, like, the one Black person at your work to be like the messiah for all Black people and to be at every meeting and to, like, Blacksplain everything. You know, like, those are the kinds of things we want to really avoid doing, even though sometimes that's done with really good intentions. It should always be those folks' choice on how they want to participate. You know, we have people of color within our organization who, they're not perhaps interested in joining a DEI committee. They're not interested in talking about these things. They're very comfortable in the role. They may not even want to advance, and that's all okay. So it's about just being, ultimately, I would say, self-aware about all of these kinds of things and making those kinds of changes. What do you think, James?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always amazed at how you and I have so much in common. We're often on the same page, and I think it's because of that narrow passage that we both have had to walk separately in this universe without knowing one another. There's something to be said about that unique pathway. I think that bring, it's almost a mind meld. But directly to the point, I really struggle with it. I struggle with it because so many, I think there is one thing about saying that you want to help someone else. I think that I think is understandable and compassionate, but I think you have to do your due diligence. You have to really dig in and do the work and learn more about what the person's going to, but also to your point, Jose, and I think most importantly is giving space. Giving space and also giving away your power, because ultimately white supremacy is not about solely about violence of white people on Black people. It's not about lynching. It's not about car bombs or church bombs. It's about taking power and ruling over and suppressing other people. So white supremacy is about suppressing. And if you really want to fight white supremacy, wherever it is, you start with yourself. And you don't take this new position that you might have, or even an old position, and use it to elevate yourself. I see, not just lately, but in general, in this industry and others, that folks are monetizing their awareness of Black struggle, right? I am the white person in the room. I'm in charge of a program that might be designed to serve underserved people. How can I use that to elevate myself, right? And you can easily do that by not inviting people to the table. If you are white and you have a presence and you have a voice, you should be constantly bringing unrealized voices to the table if you have that position. If you don't have that position, you should also still be talking to as many people of color as possible. Myself, I grew up in a household with three lovely sisters and a very strong mother. My mother's a very powerful woman. There is no empowering my mother. She is plenty powerful all by herself. And I have three really strong sisters, and it just so happens that I have two daughters. So, and an incredibly powerful wife, but I am not going to get on a stage, regardless of what I've learned in the past or in the present, or what I learn in the future about women and women's issues, and attempt to mansplain a woman's position. That is not my job. My job is to say, get up there on that stage and knock them dead. Say what you said to me in the kitchen, you know, say what I've heard you say over and over again my whole life. My job is to encourage the women in my life to assume the power that I know they should have. It is not for me to take on a role where I become a spokesperson. There is no movement whatsoever that's ever been successful because a powerful person stepped in and spoke for a marginalized group. Marginalized groups take on and lead their own movements. And if we have not learned that by now, I fear for us. Information is great. Enriching yourself is great. But if you are, particularly if you're in a position of power, you should be passing that mic on as often as you can. You have an obligation, a moral obligation, to pass the mic.
This is, I think, such an incredibly important conversation. The material that people are reading, the feedback that people are getting, is that systemic racism needs to be addressed within the white culture in order to eradicate it.
Yes. And
so help us, number one, understand. Exactly, because people want to do the right thing. People are hungry and eager to get information that's going to help them move the needle. So I'd like to hear more specifically how we do that.
I think Jose described it as giving space in the room, not to take up too much space in the room. There are, and this does not mean that there are evil people amongst us. but I think we're all human. I think our egos get in the way. If you are a part of animal welfare royalty and you are a white woman, which you are very likely to be if you're part of that subset, right, of that pioneering group, I think it's hard for all of us to go, oh, wait a second, I'm going to have to share this space with someone that wasn't previously part of animal welfare royalty. What does that mean? Does that mean I will get less speaking engagements? Does that mean I will have less consultants, consultancy and contracts? I mean, human ego is a thing I think we just have to deal with. And it's not, by the way, in my mind, about white ego versus Black ego. There's plenty of Black people with egos. It's just about humanity, right? And so, but to tackle that, we really do, we have to say, who can I elevate, particularly when we're bringing up subject matter that's about people of color? There's so many benefits to it, and I think unrealized benefits, including donors. There are a lot of wealthy brown people out there, and I think if they knew more about the sort of the grounding of Pets for Life, you could create a whole new donor base based on the fact that you are making these partnerships with leaders of color and communities of color at the same time.
In development or philanthropy committee meetings, where I have advocated for fundraisers and fundraising outreach to the Latino community, and I was told that they are not a philanthropic group. And so for me, it was very challenging to know that not only is that believed, it is widely spread. And so, you know, and when you talked about data earlier, you were talking about we have to look at the data. And so what the data tells anybody is that perhaps the Latino community is not as philanthropic. But the question is, where's that data coming from? Who are they surveying? And is that data really reflective of the philanthropy of that community?
What should we as an industry, as animal welfare, what should we be doing differently to change this? I mean, because you're talking about bringing a certain population to the conversation. We're talking about data. We're talking about what history's told us. So Jose, what do you think we should be doing differently as an industry to start changing things that have been happening in the past?
I think the first step is challenge all these narratives that we have that are usually not predicated in real truth. It may be a version of the truth. We all know you can slice and dice whatever you want your narrative to be. And so I think that's the first kind of step, you know, whether we're talking about donors, but I've always found whenever we are talking about whether it's life-saving programs or anything that is about proactively addressing the solution, people of color oftentimes aren't thought of as folks who can participate in those conversations, who are actually integral parts of the solution equation, more so as what we talked about, they're more of who we're serving, you know? And I think about, like, especially from the donation perspective, I think about my family. We grew up poor, but you better believe my grandmother emptied her dollars into Catholic Church. Like that, like there was, or it's a different kind of, like when we talk about generosity, like we had nothing. We grew up on food stamps. My mom would make dinner for whoever needed a plate to eat. To this day, she still is on food stamps, and she still will, like, whatever she has, she'll share. And so I think these communities, the ones I come from, are some of the most generous of self, of spirit, and whatever they have. So I think we need to change that, especially when we look at how a lot of these campaigns, especially when I look at and study political campaigns, specifically like Bernie Sanders, like it was those dollars, the $5, right, that really galvanized that. Can you imagine if we just took a different approach and were more inclusive and got people to be part of the conversation and part of the solution? Because, you know, James always tells a story about people when he was working in Pets for Life, like, the folks in the community who are doing the work already, you know, I think, is it Miss Betty, James? It's Miss Betty, you know? And so it's the Miss Betty's of the world who are already doing the work. They're out there. It's about helping them get more organized, if that's so what they want, to have even a greater impact, right? And so I think it's about just changing up our narratives and looking at, well, what are we trying to accomplish? and approaching it with a brand new perspective of true inclusivity. Like, I think that that just kind of changes everything. And part of by having a more diverse workforce means your connection to those communities, it's going to be more fluid. You know, the way we engage, the way we communicate and talk to those communities probably needs to reflect the language and the, me and James were talking about the word lexicon the other day. I was like, if someone came to my neighborhood and told my mom, like, use the word lexicon, she'd be like, yes, so what's like, what are you saying to me? That means nothing, you know? And right. I think a lot of times our campaigns, the way we approach community engagement is very whitewashed. It's very Eurocentric, you know? And so, yeah. And so then they put, you know, the same marketing campaign that goes out to community X, which is white, middle class, affluent potentially. And they think by just churning it in Spanish and just taking it to another zip code that solves everything. And it doesn't. Like, the word, the phrasing, the soul of it needs to change. And the best folks who are going to actually help inform that are people from those communities, whether they work there or whether you're going and actually not engaging in a term of like, we're here to serve. It's like, what's needed and really being of service to people. James always talks about like the word empowering, and I'm even watching how I use that word. It's like, these folks are powerful. It's about how do we take our foot off the neck of the suppressed? How do we do that, you know?
Yes, and it's about including. I have, because I have a mass comms background, often we're doing research on lexicon and on phrases and on words and on adjectives. And so often, you know, we'll have a client that will say, oh, we tried XYZ campaign and it just doesn't work when we talk to that audience. And I say, well, how much consumer research did you use? Did you use a writer from the community? Did you include insights from the community before you wrote your copy? This goes for mass communications. This goes again for development. Is your developer of someone of color, right? If your developer is a white woman who is soliciting a very wealthy Black family or a Latino family, and they go to your website and they don't see any representation whatsoever in your organization from a leadership standpoint, you very well may not get a gift. But if you are including in your leadership, and your leadership of color is soliciting another leader of color, and you're doing it in a way that is earnest, I think things would shift. So, you know, here in Baltimore, we have Maryland, there are a plethora of very wealthy Black families. The Brown family is one of them. They give millions and millions of dollars to Maryland Institute College of Art. And so the money is there. Eddie Brown is one of the wealthiest men on the East Coast. I mean, he has a financial firm. You have to have $5 million just to become one of his clients. That's the kind of investment he does. And so to think that the money's not there is ludicrous. And to think that he's not generous is ludicrous. So the question becomes, what is your ask? You know, is the messenger the right messenger? And often we all know the messenger matters. The physical messenger matters in some instances, but the written message matters and your previous messages matter. So if you have the right messenger and the right ask, but then I'm going to your website and there is no commitment to communities of color historically by your organization, and there are no leaders of color in your organization. If your organization turns on the dime to mention someone, the moment that someone mentions Me Too, but they won't turn on a dime if someone mentions Black Lives Matter, I'm going to notice that. You may not be the person that I'm going to give $2 million to. So I think we have to, and always think holistically, you know, what would you want from a person that you didn't know who was entering your home? What would you want them to say to you before they asked you for something? You would want some relationship building. You would want to know some historical relevance for that person in that space. Or are they just asking you for money because they need it for right that moment? Or are they trying to truly partner with your household? I think we often forget that regardless of organizations, what we're really talking about is interpersonal relationship building, right? That the whether or not it's employment or it's asking for a donation, it's all interpersonal. You are still dealing with a human being, conversing or confiding or asking something of another human being. And I think we just have to slow down and say, what would I want from a stranger?
Just listening to both of you talk is inspiring. It's actually, I'm taking notes down as you guys are talking because I feel, I know I'm learning from both of you right now. And I think animal welfare is just an interesting bird on its own, right? We are a small industry compared to all other industries in the country. And James, you said this earlier, you said egos, right? We tend to have big egos, especially when we as an industry are divided either locally within the state or nationally, if we're with a national organization or not, or how we do, or I see it always sometimes as a game of capture the flag. Who gets there first, right? Who gets the flag first? And then that's the next big thing. How do we make DEI the next big thing? Because we always focus on saving animals, and saving animals is our priority, but we have to take care of our people in order to save those animals. So how, like, what would be your recommendation, your advice on keeping DEI as part of the conversation moving forward for us in animal welfare?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. It comes to, this is a very small pond with lots of big fish, right? In many instances, and that capture the flag thing is, I think, a perfect articulation of that. And there is a rush to sort of be the first to get there. There's a rush, I think, and even to be the first to elevate DEI, and often not in a compelling way or well thought out way, just to be able to say, well, hell, we're a big organization and we ought to be talking about this right now. And I was telling my wife the other day, it reminds me of when you have an ego, and we all do, right? You break a glass, the first thing you want to do is pick that glass up, even if you cut yourself. And really you should be thinking, I just broke something. How did that happen, right? What's the best way to clean this up that doesn't create more shards on the ground? And I think ultimately the way things happen in this industry, it comes from top down. It comes from the Maddie's funds. It comes from the PetSmart charities, the animal grant makers, and everyone that makes up the large grantors in this field. When the grantors say, this is important, we're going to commit to this level of spending on DEI and diversity inclusion, that's when, you know, things I think are really going to be significant. When we're able to tie it into budget, when a funder like a PetSmart Charities or a Petco or a Maddie's Fund is looking at an organization like yours and you're asking for, you know, $100,000, and they go, but wait, what does your adoption look like? Is your adoption diverse? Is your leadership diverse? Is your board diverse? Before we commit financially to your organization, you need to show us that you are thinking about people in the same spirit that you're thinking about pets. And by the way, inclusion equals life-saving. If we add more people of color to the team, we're going to save more animals. They are not one thing here and another thing over here. Just the 5% increase in adoption by people of color will save 2.2 million animals, right? 2.2 million animals will leave the shelter with just a 5% increase in adoption amongst people of color. And so it, like in most things in life, when you are doing the right thing, all kinds of little other right things happen without you having to do them. You know, so if you're raising your children with love and compassion, you're putting people on the earth that are going to share that. It just, it happens. And so if we start with people, we start with love and compassion, we start with inclusion at the top of funding as a qualification, the funders know the field is not diverse. And so as soon as funders make it important and make it a bar that organizations have to ascend to, we're gonna see major, major changes in the field.
Yeah, and I would say from an organizational perspective, it's about really committing to this work. It's hard, it's full of landmines. It's why a lot of folks avoid it because it's charged. There, people are afraid to say the right or wrong thing. And I think for us, it's about integrating it in every aspect of our operations at Best Friends. So for instance, we are not looking at our DEI work as like, and Julie Castle always says, it's not about an initiative on the side.
Yep.
We were recently refreshing our roadmap to 2025. And we didn't add a new DEI pillar. It was, how do we infuse DEI in every aspect of this roadmap? We're approaching it through our culture. Culture is how you do things around here. How do we make DEI part of our culture? And so right now we're having to do things really strategically and deliberately to interrupt the system and systems at play. But the goal is to get to a place where it becomes just part of the way we do things. It becomes just part of the consideration that you have when you're making decisions about programs, hiring, life-saving programs, all of those different things. And so for us, we looked at having culture councils, and we took a look at our operations and created these six councils that are really going to be focusing on infusing diversity, equity, and inclusion principles in all aspects across the organization. And this group of committee members, we have 60 employees at Best Friends who are all working at this, and we have 12 leadership positions of these councils who are going to make up Julie Castle's CEO Advisory Council, so that they can make actual recommendations that will be accepted by the senior leadership team so that change can be implemented. You know, it's super easy to make virtue signaling type things, to do things on the surface level. It's going to take deep commitment to do this really important and yet challenging work. And you're right, James, it starts at the top, and we need everybody involved and committed. So we, at one point, were, do we hire, you know, a chief diversity officer? And part of what we decided is we need everyone here to be a diversity officer at Best Friends. Every single employee needs to approach their work with that in mind. How do we help them do that? And so we're also starting with competencies, helping people learn new concepts about the different people's experiences across all diversity dimensions, so that we're more poised to have those hard conversations. So those are just some of the things we're doing right now.
Jose, one of the things, and one of the things we were talking about in our DEI committee before we actually jumped on this call, was talking about Latino versus Latina versus Latinos versus Latinx, right? So now, you know, you got BIPOC out there, now we got, should we be saying Latino and Latina or Latinx? And so yeah, the conversations are coming out, and we're having those conversations. I just love the way both of you are approaching this, again, as global. It's not this one thing like, okay, this is how it's supposed to be done. It's so complex, but we need to be paying attention to it. Some of our organizations, whether national, locally, whatever, might have had the diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation like, hey, we need to be talking about this constantly. It's now coming out in the open. And I just want to make sure, as part of the, you know, the being on the committee with the association on the DEI committee, I just want to make sure that I play a part in supporting both of you in all the work you're doing. And of course, supporting Catherine. But it's what I want to make sure the conversation is had. And I know it's uncomfortable. And I know there's going to be, you know, organizations or individuals that just don't know where to go. And to build those resources, or to have individuals like yourselves that, you know, you're not only preaching it, but you walk the talk and you talk the
talk.
That is a big, big, big difference on, you know, helping others who might just feel like I'm scared to say something. Yeah. Don't know what to do next, and knowing that we have these resources in, you know, with yourselves to be able to say, hey, I'm just a phone call.
Yeah.
I'm a Zoom call away. So I really appreciate all the information you have shared here. I have a feeling this is going to be able to be continued, where I think we dig deeper into more either complex or more pointed issues instead of just kind of approaching it on a global platform.
Jorge, is that your way of asking them to come back and talk to us again?
Yes, that is.
And also his way to be like, we gotta go.
Yeah, well, no, and Catherine's the one that calls the time. I'm here. I can listen to you, I can have this conversation and listen to both of you, because I've been doing animal welfare forever, and I've been in this industry forever, and I've seen it change. I've seen it where euthanasia was the right thing to do, and now it's just like frowned upon, and our adoption programs and what we do, and community outreach never existed. You couldn't afford the animal, you weren't meant to have it. Now we're trying to help folks keep their pets no matter what. So I've seen the change this industry, this profession has made in the years. I think we just have amazing leaders in the right positions today to make this change happen and stick. Not, oh, we'll go back. Oh, no. I think, folks like yourself who are saying, no, this is the direction we should be going. I think we're ready to make that leap and change this industry once and for all.
So I just want to thank you both for being with us today. I know that this will be the start of an ongoing conversation. And Jorge, as usual, I love that you're my co-host. And you need to start thinking about what's next. What are we going to talk about next?
Yeah, and one of the things that came up in our conversation that I think should be on our agenda for next conversation is we have a lot of nonprofits that are struggling with a diversity on the board. And we know that the board determines employment for that executive director, the CEO, so that it is a very fragile conversation on how much can a CEO or an executive director push a board to become diverse, and where do you go to recruit those, that diversity? So I think we need to put that on the agenda for future conversations for sure. So Jose, James, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So y'all take care, and we'll stay in touch.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.